Good morning, brethren. I also want to say welcome to anyone that might be listening in on the internet. We do have occasionally people from time to time will pull up sermons or sermonettes and listen in to us. This obviously not live, but after they've been posted. I just got a text from my wife, said Max is 103.6 temperature now, so she just gave him some, I guess she gave him some medicine to try and bring that down, but this is the time of the season where this stuff goes around. And when you're younger, you don't seem to have the immunity, and you're developing. So you, when you get older, you can take care of the little ones, kids or grandchildren. I'd like to start off my sermon today by reading an illustration. I think this came from, It came from some place on Blogspot. Someone had posted up there. It says this: there once was a stonecutter who was dissatisfied with himself and with his position in life. One day he passed a wealthy merchant's house, and through the open gateway he saw many fine possessions and important visitors. How powerful that merchant must be, thought the stonecutter. He became very envious and wished that he could be like the merchant, and to his great surprise he suddenly became the merchant, enjoying more luxuries and power than he had ever imagined, but envied and detested by those less wealthy than himself. And soon a high official passed by, carried in a sedan chair, accompanied by attendants and escorted by soldiers beating gongs. Everyone, no matter how wealthy, had to bow low before the procession. How powerful that official is, he thought. I wish I could be a high official. And then he became the high official, carried everywhere in his embroidered sedan chair, feared and hated by all the people all around. And it was a hot summer day too, so the official felt more uncomfortable in the sticky sedan chair. He looked up at the sun, and it shone proudly in the sky, unaffected by his presence. How powerful the sun is, he thought. I wish I could be the sun. And then he became the sun, shining fiercely down upon everyone, scorching the fields, cursed by the farmers and laborers. But a huge black cloud moved between him and the earth so that his light could no longer shine on everything below. How powerful that storm cloud is, he thought. I wish I could be a cloud. And then he became the cloud, flooding the fields and villages, shouted at by everyone. But soon he found that he was being pushed away by some great force and realized that it was the wind. How powerful that wind must be, he thought. I wish I could be the wind. And then he became the wind, blowing tiles off the roofs of houses, uprooting trees, feared and hated by all below him. But after a while, he ran up against something that would not move, no matter how forcefully he blew against it. A huge towering rock. How powerful that rock must be, he thought. I wish I could be a rock. And then he became the rock, more powerful than anything else on earth. But as he stood there, he heard the sound of a hammer pounding a chisel into the hard surface, and felt himself being changed. What could be more powerful than a rock, he thought. And he looked down and saw far below him the figure of a stonecutter. So there he was, back where he started. You know, contentment in life may be one of our greatest challenges. All too often we're not content with living in the now. We're not content with the things that we have. We're not content with the station in life that we've been dealt or given. These are battles in the mind. In Ephesians chapter 6, and you can turn over to Ephesians chapter 6, Paul tells us, the Apostle Paul does, that even though these are physical realms that we live in, this is a physical tent, there is something beyond that that we battle against. And he says in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12 that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but we wrestle against principalities and against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, and against spiritual wickedness in high places. And so the battles that we have in this world actually occur in the mind. But there are boundaries that God has set for us not to cross. And he's given us relationship rules. He set up boundaries that have to do with our heart, and boundaries that have to do with our desires. boundaries that have to do with our drives and our motives. And these are the prime movers in all commandment transgressing. However, it is the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet, that has to do with our private thoughts. It has to do with our inner workings, the things that roll around in our head. I mean, everyone can see the outward manifestation of me breaking almost every other commandment. You can tell, obviously, if someone kills someone, many times you can tell if someone's lying to you, or if someone commits adultery. These are outward manifestations. But there's no letter of the law to transgress in the 10th commandment. These are things that work in the mind. How are you to know if I'm, for instance, coveting your house of grandeur? How do you know if I'm coveting your beautiful wife? Or how do you know if I'm coveting your daughter's generosity? Or I'm coveting your job security or your health because it's so good? How do you know that? You don't. These are things that take place in the mind. It's all in the mind. It all happens in our private thoughts. And yet thoughts manifest attitudes, and they ultimately bring about actions. You see, private thoughts, if they're wrong, can lead to consuming passions, and they will absolutely wreck your life and my life. I think there are three primary thoughts or beliefs, if you will, or lies that we believe that will produce these consuming passions that answer the question why we have so much and yet we are so discontented in this life. The first private thought is this. It's the lie that more is never enough. It's the lie that more is never enough. It's a private thought. It's not something that we think out loud. We don't analyze it. It's just a deep-seated private thought that more is never enough. And since more is never enough, it produces this sort of a drivenness in us that the more we have, the more we get, we actually deceive ourselves into believing that this more will somehow satisfy our longing, our discontentedness. There was an article that I had found from U.S. News and World Report. This is way back in 1992, a long time ago now. But it was a poll conducted about the American dream, and the article had noted that for Americans with household incomes of under $25,000, it said it would take $54,000 a year to fulfill the American dream for someone who lived at that $25,000 level. But for those who made $100,000, they said fulfill the American dream, it would need to be at $192,000. And so the conclusion that you can draw is it doesn't really matter where you're at. You almost want to double everything that you have to be able to reach what's called the American dream. It's always twice the distance away. It's always over the horizon. Whatever we have isn't enough. You know, this is really what happened to King David. King David, you remember the story, goes out one night and he sees a beautiful woman bathing across the way on the rooftop. Her name was Bathsheba. And he coveted his neighbor's wife. No one heard his thoughts. No one saw the thought cloud over his head. No one could tell anything about what he was thinking. No one heard any of that. But he made a decision that produced an action because he wanted more than he already had. And that desire welled up in him, and that consuming passion that he had. And it sets up this false cascade of a false belief that sets up this cascade of events that does irreparable damage. And in his case, what happened with King David? Think of all the things that came out of this one thought, out of his head, from the death of Uriah the Hittite, Bathsheba's husband, to the disconnect or the anger that came up and welled up within Ahithophel, which was Bathsheba's grandfather, and the problems that came from that. And of course, the sexual immorality of Absalom when he took David's concubines and he went into them on the rooftop in front of everyone in Israel, and to the death of David's son that resulted because of that relationship that he had with Bathsheba. That one thought brought about a huge cascade of events. And that thought crossed a boundary, and it was called coveting. And he believed the lie that more is never enough. Number two, the second lie that we believe is called when-then thinking. When-then. When I get this, then I'll be happy. When I graduate, then I'll be happy. When I have this job, then I'll be happy. When I'm married, I'll be happy. When I get the promotion, I'll be happy. When I'm a few pounds lighter, I'll be happy. When I move out of this dump, I will be happy. And you can go on and on and on. This is when-then thinking. And when-then is a lie. When-then does not produce contentment. It never has and it never will. And if more than enough thinking produces this drive towards lust, then when-then thinking produces an ultimate disillusionment. We ultimately become disillusioned by that thinking. You know, even people like you and me, we believe this lie. We buy into this lie, this when-then thinking. It's like something on the next horizon. It's got to be better. It's going to be better. It's going to make us happier. We think it's got to make us happy if we get the new car, or we get the new outfit, or we get the new house, or we get the new book, or we get the new phone. Or if we lose 10 pounds, or if we gain 10 pounds, no matter which side of the spectrum you're on. And when we get there, and it does not bring the contentment that we seek, then we chase the next horizon into disillusionment. We are under the illusion that these things will bring us the contentment that we seek, but they don't. They don't bring us those. And when we get to that rainbow, and we go to the end of the rainbow, and we look at that pot, and we see it's empty, we say, well, where did all the gold go? Maybe the leprechaun took it. Maybe he stole it and went away. Well, the truth is, the gold was never there in the first place. It was never there in the first place. There was a story, actually part of his life, that Deion Sanders had written in a book that he had wrote. Deion Sanders is a football player, retired football player. He played on three NFL championship teams, has three Super Bowl rings. One of the best cornerbacks in the history of the game. He was a non-believer. He didn't believe in God for most of his life while he was growing up and in playing football. But here's what he wrote. I want to read you something that he wrote after he won his first Super Bowl. He had reached the height of the world in the football arena. He won the Super Bowl. I think it was with the San Francisco 49ers, I believe it was with them. And here's what he wrote. He said, I remember winning the Super Bowl that year. And that night after the game, I was the first one out of the locker room and the first one onto the press conference and the first one to go home. And I remember my wife, Carolyn, saying to me, baby, you just won the Super Bowl. Don't you have to have a party downstairs or something to go to? And I said, nah, and rolled over and went to sleep. And that was the same week I bought myself a brand new $275,000 Lamborghini. And I hadn't even driven it a mile before I realized, no, that's not it. That's not what I'm looking for. It's got to be something else. I'm so hungry. I've tried everything, parties, women, buying expensive jewelry and gadgets, and nothing helped. There was no peace. I mean, I was playing great. I got all this media attention and everything the world has to offer. But no peace, no joy, just emptiness inside. The Bible describes it in the first chapter of Ecclesiastes as chasing after the wind. And that's exactly what it was like. I tried to buy myself something to make me happy, and I was even more empty than I was before because I could see that nothing could possibly satisfy the hunger that was deep down inside of me. I tried throwing myself into my career, into sports, trying to see how far I could go, and when I achieved every goal that I could think of, I was right back where I started. Empty, empty, empty. And nothing I could do, nothing I could touch, I'm sorry, and nothing I did could touch the deep loneliness inside of me. I was running, and I couldn't stop. End quote. You know, our private thoughts determine our consuming passions. And the when-then fallacy inevitably leads to the road of disillusionment. And the story of Deion Sanders shows it as well as anything. He had everything that this world could offer in terms of wealth, in terms of notoriety, in terms of power, in a very, let's say, an important world in this society. And yet he came up empty. Number three is this. The third lie that we believe, or the third private thought we have, is that of comparing ourselves to others. Comparing ourselves to others. And this, frankly, starts out when we are very little. I mean, when we're outside and we were playing when we were children, and we got in arguments with our neighborhood kids, and we said, "Oh yeah, my dad is stronger than your dad. Oh yeah, my dad is bigger than your dad." You know, we always had to compare him to someone else. We couldn't just say, "My dad's strong." "Oh yeah, my dad's better." And when we got older, it wasn't, you know, what we got on our report card. It was what we got on a report card compared to our brother, or compared to our sister, or compared to our friend. How did we do compared to them? You know, and you may have got a 91 or a 92 on your test, and you think, "That's pretty good. I got an A." And you ask your friend, "Well, how did you do?" And they say, "Well, I got a 97. Well, all of a sudden, maybe I'm not so happy anymore with my 91 or 92. Because now I'm coveting that 97 that my friend got, and I didn't feel happy for him. And I say, "Oh man, you're so lucky." And luck has nothing to do with it, really. It had to do with hard work, maybe talent, maybe God-given abilities. But we like to measure how we're doing by how others are doing. When what we should be doing is saying, "Well, this is what God gave me. This is who I am, and this is success that I've worked for." But we believe a private thought that produced a consuming passion. And so we have magazines like People Magazine, and they'll give you the top 10 sexiest people of the year. Or they'll give you the top 10 best dressed people of the year. Or they're the most interesting people of the year, the Time Magazine Person of the Year award. And often we look, you know, we don't think about, or what, maybe we'll think about the bigwigs in Hollywood or Wall Street, and we'll think about all the things they have, and we'll kind of desire that and crave that and wish we had some of those things. And we'll look at the guy driving down the road in that beautiful Mercedes, and we're sitting there driving our Yugo and wish we had that Mercedes that they were in. Or the girl has, man, beautiful trendy clothes. I wish I could dress like her. Wish I had the money to be able to do that. Or big giant wedding rings. Love to have one of those. You see, when we look at someone else and we compare ourselves to them and their success, and the lie becomes, how am I doing compared to someone else? How am I doing compared to someone else? And all it can ever produce is dissatisfaction. There is always going to be someone that has more, that has better, that is some way more advanced, that we think is more advanced than us. We can never be happy. We can never be happy, not deep down, because you can always find someone that you can compare at your age group and say, "I wish I was there. 45, look at what this 45-year-old is doing. I'm 65, look how they're retiring in their life. I wish I had what they had. I wish I was more well-known. I wish I was more well-liked. I wish I had better brains. I wish I had a better body." We can wish and wish, and when then, and we can think about all these things and compare ourselves to everything. But this produces a consuming passion in our lives. I'd like you to turn to Acts chapter 4. Acts chapter 4. Here in Acts, after the day of Pentecost came in chapter 2, there were many people around the area that had come up to Jerusalem for the feast, and they became converted on this day. The Holy Spirit came into 3,000 people. They saw a new way of life. They saw a new world that had been opened up to them, a new knowledge that was there. And a lot of them didn't have the means to stay around. They didn't have the money to stay around longer to learn about this new way of life. And so in remarkable acts of sacrifice to help those that had desired to stay and learn. Look what they did in Acts chapter 4 and verse 34. Neither was there any among them that lacked. For as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the pieces of things that were sold and laid them down at the apostles' feet, and distribution was made unto every man according as he had need. And Joseph, who was the apostles, was surnamed Barnabas, which is being interpreted the son of consolation, a Levite, and of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it and brought the money, and he laid it at the apostles' feet. And so we see here that many different people had sold their possessions, sold things that they had, houses or land, and they had brought this money and they had laid it at the apostles' feet, so that all of the people that could not afford to stay in Jerusalem could now stay there so they could learn about this new way of life. And we see here that Barnabas is singled out for recording in this book of Acts for the thing that he did. And it's a striking account of sincere, loving liberality by giving up something of great price to help others further their knowledge in their new found vocation of following Christ. But then in chapter 5, we see another striking account. Quite the opposite. It's written in contrast to the sincerity of Barnabas. In chapter 5 and verse 1, we read, "But a certain man named Ananias, with Sapphira his wife, sold a possession and kept back the part of the price, and his wife also was privy to it, and brought a certain part, just a part of it, and laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and keep back part of the price of the land? While it remained with you, was it not your own? And after it was sold, was it even not then in your own power? Why have you conceived this thing in your heart, that you have lied unto men, lied not unto men, but unto God? And Ananias, hearing these words, fell and gave up the ghost, and great fear came upon all them that heard these things." And then we know that Sapphira came, I think it was about 3 hours later, and she fell down dead as well. What were they doing? They were deceitful as they came before the apostles, and they weren't content with just giving less. They could have done that if they wanted to. That wouldn't have been a problem. Peter said, wasn't it yours when you owned it, when you had it? Wasn't it yours when you sold it? You still owned it. You could have given whatever you had wanted to. They could have kept some back. That would have been okay. But as soon as they laid it at the apostles' feet and they lied about it, and this is a private thought that they had in their head, no one else heard this. Peter said, it was yours. It was under your own power. You didn't have to sell it. But Ananias and Sapphira saw what Barnabas did. They saw what the others in the church were doing, what they were doing around them, and they compared themselves to the spirituality of others. And they developed a consuming passion for notoriety, for having a better view, maybe, in the eyes of the brethren there. And that's what the Bible calls coveting. They coveted what others had, even if it was immaterial. Each one of these private thoughts produces a characteristic that is manifested in our actions. More is never enough produces an insatiable drivenness of lust and greed. When then thinking produces disillusionment, because you'll never be satisfied. And comparing ourselves to others produces dissatisfaction if we're not content with who we are or what we have been given. Each has a common root in what God calls coveting. Coveting. Now the Hebrew word for covet means an inner desire. It's an inner desire. It means to delight in an urge or to delight in passion. It means to be highly motivated, to be driven, to lust after, to be compelled, to have that I can't live without it impulse. But the word in and of itself really is just a neutral word. The word also is used to have a desire of coveting for Jerusalem, God says. God has a desire, a passion. He covets to have an intimate relationship with you and with me. But when this kind of desire is mischanneled, when it's negative, it draws us away from God, and then it begins to corrupt our relationships with people. And we see it in the New Testament also as lust. So our definition really is an inordinate, ungoverned, selfish desire that leads you away from God and corrupts our relationships with people. And that's what it means to covet. An inordinate, ungoverned, selfish desire that leads us away from God. And it destroys our relationships with others. And the scripture says that you shall not covet anything. Anything that belongs to your neighbor. Nothing. And the 10th commandment is the command of the heart. The other 9 talk about our heart as well and our behavior, our priorities. But number 10 talks about the inside, something that you cannot see. This is the command that deals with our thinking, our wants, our desires, our dreams, and what goes on there when no one else can see. This is one thing we can say for certain, that we'll never be happy if we covet. These desires like more is never enough, when then thinking and comparing ourselves with others, brings us to a place that can guarantee only one thing. There's only one outcome, and that is discontentedness. Discontentedness. How can we be content in this world? How can we be discontented in this world? If you want to be discontented, break the 10th commandment. I guarantee you'll be discontented. In coveting, you'll never be happy. You'll never be satisfied. You'll never experience joy in life. Because the moment you receive something that is pure, an unadulterated gift from God, the Father above who loves us all, the moment we receive that, we just shift our eyes to something else. We've got that. Let's move on to something else. We'll look across the fence and we'll see that the grass looks greener on the other side. We'll look and we'll see that we feel like God's giving or has given someone else something better than he's given us. And we'll be dissatisfied with what we have. Carol was watching some kids the other day at our house, and these 2 girls and our 2 boys were sitting down with Faith in sort of this circle. And she had given all these kids little suckers. And they were sucking on these little suckers, and as they were sitting around with their lips just tightly pursed around those little suckers with that little white stick sticking out of their mouths and just all happy. And Faith didn't have one. And she looked around. And she wanted one of those. And she was pointing. And see, all the kids have one, but she didn't. You see, it begins at an early age, and it's difficult to stop. Well, she got her sucker. And she was happy. But God says to you and to me, he says, don't covet. He says, don't covet because you won't have peace. You won't have joy. You'll never be satisfied. And if you don't accept the things that God has freely given us, God has given us things to be thankful for, but instead we always look at what other people have. I have 5 symptoms that rob our joy of living. There are 5 symptoms that tell us, and they give us warnings, they tell us, they give us signs of consuming passions that are robbing our joy in life. And they let us know how deeply coveting may be buried in our hearts so that we can look at these things and we can root them out and develop an attitude of complete and utter contentment and joy in our lives. Now, I'm not talking about riding some high wave all the time, like you're surfing and it's just, whoa, fantastic all the time. Every moment is just a moment of utter excitement and bliss. No, these are emotions. And emotions go up and down. But rooting out coveting can smooth out these emotions because they're tied to contentment and they're tied to joy. What I'm talking about is providing space for the fruit of the Spirit. Provide space in your heart for these things to develop and to grow. Provide fertile ground for those fruits to grow by removing the toxic works of the flesh of coveting. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, kindness, faith, meekness. I think I added an extra one there, temperance. There's a between King James and New King James, there's some similarity there. But what we're talking about is joy. We're talking about contentment, peace in our lives. Those are the two, really, I think we can understand, and we can help grow by the things that we can look at to see what robs our daily life of joy, of contentment. What's robbing us of these things? Well, I have five things. Number one is this. Number one is fatigue. Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 4. Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 4. What is robbing us of joy and peace? Fatigue or that feeling of being stressed out? Proverbs 23 and verse 4. Labor not to be rich. Cease from your own wisdom. Will you set your eyes upon that which is not, that which you don't have? For riches certainly make themselves wings, and they fly away as an eagle towards heaven. Now, this does not mean, by the way, this does not mean that you cannot be rich. This does not mean that you should not be rich. There are we have examples of the Bible of very rich people that God had blessed. That's not what he's saying here. And there are many reasons to labor, brethren. There are many reasons to labor. You can labor for your family, to do your best to make sure that your family is cared for, not only now, but in the future. Those are good things to labor for. Paul writes in 1 Timothy chapter 5 that if one doesn't care for his own family, he's worse than an infidel. So it's good to labor for your family, or for your extended family, or for the church family. Paul also writes in 2 Timothy 3, you can write this down, that if a man does not work, he does not eat. So we can labor for others who cannot labor for themselves. And you can labor to enjoy the fruits that come from that labor. God tells us he wants to enjoy those things. You can enjoy the labor itself even. Some people just enjoy labor. And you can enjoy the labor. It feels good to work hard and to accomplish something. That feels good. Or the enjoyment of the goodly pleasure that labor can buy. God tells us to enjoy the fruits of the labor. But one reason that we should not labor for, he says, is to be rich. For that reason alone, that is a dead end. And I think along with rich, you could put famous or successful or for appearance's sake, any number of things. But whatever it is, don't wear yourself out at whatever it may be. Don't wear yourself out. Do you live a high-speed life? Do you work long hours? And this is not just for you, but for anybody that may be listening in. You work 80 hours a week. Some people work 100-hour weeks. Or does your conversation pop up about how stressed you always are, how hard you're always going, how you need a break, how you stay up late, how you haven't had much sleep? You see, all of these things give this idea. You see, godly ambition and hard work, God always says yes to. He will always say yes to that every time. But a consuming desire that causes us to neglect God and other important relationships probably has to do with the level of coveting that is in our hearts. Now think about this for a minute. God is really there, which he is, and he really loves us, which he does. And we're so busy, and we're so pushed, and we're so driven that we don't have the time to take with him on a daily basis and just to spend, even if it's 10 or 15 minutes a day, just talking to him and then letting him talk back to us in the words of the Bible. If we don't even have time for that, what's important in our life? What's important in our life? If we're so important and so busy and so stressed that we don't have time for the creator of the universe, the creator of our soul, for the molder of our character, then we have coveting in our hearts. And I would suggest, if that's the case, that we have bought into the lie that more isn't enough, that when then thinking, then has deceived us. And if we push it, God will simply step aside and he'll say, go right ahead. Do what you like. But understand that if you're going to be doing this, you're going to come to disillusionment. You're going to be worn out. You're going to be stressed. But you can do that on your own. Number two reason that symptoms that rob our joy of living is debt. Number two is debt. I want to read from the Contemporary English Version, Ecclesiastes chapter 5. We're going to read a few scriptures from Ecclesiastes. You can probably hold your spot there if you like. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Again, this is from the Contemporary English Version. I like the way this reads. But Solomon wrote here, he said, the more you have, the more everyone expects from you. You could also say the more you have, the more you have to take care of. He goes on to say in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 11, your money won't do you any good. Others will just spend it for you. Or the more money you have, the more you will spend. Have you ever thought, man, I got this bonus coming. I got this raise. I know I'm going to collect this annuity or this paycheck or something or an inheritance. Why don't we go out and buy a new car? I mean, we're going to get the money anyway. Or we've got an extra $200 coming in a month from this new promotion, this new raise. Why don't we go and spend an extra $100 that we don't have just yet and borrow that and get something that we really wanted? This is what I'm talking about. The more we have, the more we spend. It's easy to spend money, the more you make. Or one spouse may fall into the symptom of fatigue, seeking endless riches, right? Or one may fall into debt by spending everything that the one seeking endless riches makes. They spend everything and more, and this is more common than you think. Somebody in society, some man, may have a great job and he's making lots of money, and he may work 80, 90 hours to do it. And his wife may complain about all the work that he's doing, but then she'll go out and she'll spend all that he makes. Or vice versa. You know, debt that's not related to long-term appreciation is a symptom of coveting. There was a study conducted several years ago, and it said that 93% of all teenage girls in America said if they could do anything, anything, the top of their list was, and it moved past, spending time with their boyfriend. This thing did. It was go to the mall. That was the number one thing. Go to the mall. Now, what do teenage girls do at the mall? Well, they look for boys, but if it moved past having boyfriends, you know, you kind of maybe will move that out. Maybe it's to look good. It's to see what others think about them. Or it's to buy things. You want to purchase stuff. And they go to buy things that they can't afford with money that they don't have to buy things that they don't need. And teenage girls aren't the only ones that do that. We all do that with the when-then attitude. When I get that, then I'll be happy. What's the last thing that you really wanted that you remember? And when you finally got it, you said, not as good as I thought it was going to be. And then you move on to look for something else. And you may not even remember what it was. But I can't imagine that all of us haven't had that thought. Oh man, I want that so bad. I would just love to have that. And I remember thinking recently about seeing a movie. And I thought, man, I just want to see this movie. I want to see it the week it comes out. But the odd thing is, after about 3 weeks, I thought, you know what? I don't think I care. And it's odd how these emotions play in us. But whatever those things that we want, that we can't afford, we try to finance it. If we finance that kind of debt for those kinds of reasons, whether it's a car, whether it's clothes, whether it's furniture or toys, it robs us of joy and contentment from us. It robs us of those things. Americans have closets full of stuff. They are completely loaded to the gills. And I have to ask myself, are we really happier because of it? Are we happier because of it? Do we have more joy? Do we have more contentment? Do 20 pairs of shoes make me more content and more joyful than 4? Does the latest smartphone or HDTV bring me more joy and more contentment than my old one that works just fine? You know, there are everyday people in New York and LA that get up early, that go to bed late, that put together these ads to try and figure out what it is that you want that drives you, that tries to get you to buy their product. What is it they can tell you that you need to be fulfilled? What is it that they can tell you that you need to feel sexy? that you say, I've got to have this. I want to have more friends. I've got to have this if I want to feel better about myself. I've got to have this. And so we go spend money that we don't have for things that we don't really need, for things that we can't afford. Debt tells us something about our hearts. Number three. Number three is worry. Again, I want to read this from Ecclesiastes chapter 5 from the Contemporary English Version. Drop down to verse 12, Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 12. If you have to work hard for a living, you can rest well at night, even if you don't have much to eat. But if you're rich, you can't even sleep. There's much worry. You know, a hardworking man can get a good night's rest, but a rich man has so much that he stays awake worrying. There's anxiety. Who's going to break in and get this? Am I going to keep this safe from someone, these robbers in town, these thieves? What do I got to do to make the next deal, to make the next $1,000? What am I going to do to beat my competitor across town? These are things that rich people think about at night. Brethren, have you ever gone to a place that lacks technology? Doesn't have Wi-Fi, doesn't have computers, doesn't have a shopping mall, and you don't really have a lot of stuff with you, and you don't have to drive all over town to go to the supermarket or to the mall or anything like that. And after a while, you realize, man, it takes a lot of energy to live a normal life with all the stuff in the surroundings. And wow, how relaxed and free and easy and how wonderful it is to live without all of that stuff. Just taking care of all of that stuff. It takes so much energy from us, so much worry, just to keep up with all the stuff that we own. It's just anxiety. It's just worry. If you have a house, then of course we all have to have places to live in, but you have things you have to do with the house. And the bigger the house is, the more things you have to do to that house. You have to winterize it. You have to fix repairs on things. And the bigger the house, the more walls there are, the more doors there are, the more windows there are, the more things that you've got to fix. You've got to plant flowers. You've got to pull weeds. You've got to put mulch in. You've got to put weed cover down. You've got to put killer down. You've got to, you know, shovel your drive. The longer the drive is, the more time it takes. If you live in the country, you've got to have a tractor because you've got to move all that stuff. You've got to have a bigger tractor because you've got to have a wider swath. Otherwise, it takes more time. You've got to do the oil change. You've got to do the maintenance. Every little piece of equipment, all of this takes time to maintain. You have a four-wheeler, a boat, a vehicle, a trailer. You have horses. You have animals. Everything takes up more time, and you have to keep up with the daily chores and your family and your spiritual life. You see, the more we have, the more we have to keep up with, and it seems that of all those things, it's the spiritual life that seems to fall away. That's the thing that we tend to not take time for. And how ironic it is that the very thing that helps us with our worry is the thing that we discard. We tend to put off first because of our worry over all the things that we have to do because of all the stuff we own. Number four. Number four is conflict. Things that rob our joy of living, or symptoms. Symptoms, I should say, is conflict. James chapter 4 and verse 1. You can hold your spot in Ecclesiastes here. We're going to have to come back here one last time. James chapter 4, verse 1, we read about conflict here. James says something very important to us. Again, I'll read from the Contemporary English Version. He says in 4, verse 1, why do you fight and argue with each other? Isn't it because you're full of selfish desires that fight to control your body? You want something you don't have, and you will do anything to get it. You will even kill, but you still cannot get what you want. And you won't get it by fighting and arguing. You should pray. You should pray for it. I want that because someone else has it. And they don't deserve it. They don't need it. I want it. I need it. You know, this doesn't happen in just adults. In our house, we have four Batman figurines. We have two boys. And there is always at least one that they both want. You put two cookies in front of the three children and see what happens. You know, the acid test of true friendship and relationships is when one of your friends or fellow employees or relatives gets a major promotion, or they're able to buy the kind of house that they may have wanted for years, or they're able to go on that trip to Bora Bora that you've always wanted to go on. And it spontaneously out of your heart, and it just wells up, and you think, and you say, wow, this is great. This is wonderful that you're able to have something like this. God has given you something like this. I'm so happy for you. This is a great blessing. When it wells up within you and this comes out. You know, when you can genuinely rejoice with someone's success, it means your heart is free of the cords of coveting. Number five that I have is dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 10. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 10. If you love money and wealth, you will never be satisfied with what you have. You will never be satisfied with what you'll have. You'll never get all that you want. Not with just wealth, but with anything. With anything. You'll never get enough praise. You'll never get enough respect. You'll never get enough power. You'll never get enough intimacy. You'll never get enough closeness. You'll never get enough blessings. You'll never get all that you want. And when we covet, we live a life of dissatisfaction, and it robs us of our joy and of our contentment or of our peace. And yet if we're content to live within the blessings of God, instead of walking inside of those blessings and saying, well, no, thank you, Lord, this really isn't good enough for me. I deserve something better. We can't have joy with that. We've got to live within those blessings. Then we have joy. I mean, we should ask ourselves, who am I to have a friend like this? Who am I to have a job like this? Who am I to be blessed in such a way that I have been blessed? But do you know what we tend to do? We tend to want to do? Well, how come someone else like that has got a better friend than me? Or why do they have a better house than I do? Or why do they have a better job? Or why do they have better behaved kids? Or, you know, why did God put this commandment here for us in the first place? What is it here for? It's to show us how to have a peaceful, contented, and a joy-filled life. And we will never have personal peace until coveting is rooted out of our life. You know, you'll always be in turmoil because more is never enough. And we'll always be disillusioned. We'll always be dissatisfied because we don't quite have what we always think we should have or what we always think should make us happy. And God says, don't covet for that very reason, because he says, I want you to have peace in your life. I want you to have joy in your life. Not even in just the life to come. He says, I want you to have it in this life here as well. I want you to have joy and peace. And you'll never really have this if you're always searching for something else. And to the degree that this is rooted out of my life and your life, I can really hope the best for other people. And I can enjoy their success and the blessings that God has given them instead of looking longingly at them, wishing that they were mine. You know, that's a great car you've got. That's a great job that you have. You've got a beautiful wife. You've got wonderful children. You're a wonderful organizer. God has given you tremendous wisdom. That's fantastic because I love you and I don't need all of that stuff. I'm content with what God has given me. And if I'm happy with who I am, with what God has provided me, with the relationship that I have with God today, then I should be happy. Do we believe that? Do we believe that that's all we need? God says, I want you to have joy. He says, I want you to have peace. And he knows that if we can learn to be satisfied with what he gives us and not covet and not break the other commandments as well, that he'll give us this. This will come to us naturally. because this is the way God set it in motion. This commandment, the 10th commandment, has to do with our thoughts. You see, we don't just wake up one day and we find ourselves in adultery. We don't just wake up and find ourselves in murder. It starts with a thought and then the desire, and it grows into an action. And as it says in James chapter 1, that action brings about the birth of death. What God says to you today, he says, I love you. I want you to be happy. I want you to be satisfied today. I want you to be satisfied today. Not when something changes, not if something changes, not when then, not when something happens. I want you to be happy, joyful, and content and peaceful today. I don't want to leave you today without giving you an action plan. Giving you an action plan. How do you find joy and peace and contentment? This is an action plan. There are three steps that we can take to make this operational today in our life. How does it really work? You know, everything obviously takes time. It's a process to develop. But these are things that we can work on. Philippians chapter 4, Paul writes, not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am to be content. So it's something that it takes a while. It's a learning process as well. But if we begin with how we think, we can start this. Do you realize how much ingrained more is never enough? It really is in our head. It's almost boggling to think that really is ingrained within us. This when-then thinking, it's there. And comparing ourselves to others in our lives. You know, as long as those lies remain in our mind, they create consuming passions, and these consuming passions will create this drivenness of lust and disillusionment and dissatisfaction. So step number one of our action plan is this. Very simple. Stop comparing ourselves to others. Stop comparing ourselves to others. That's the first step. That's the first step. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, we have to stop comparing ourselves to others. I'm going to go through a few scriptures here very quickly as we get closer to the end here. I know Mr. Dobson has got to get back, and I don't want to keep him too long. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12, for we dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves, but by measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves are not wise. It is an unwise thing to do. And when I compare myself with someone else, I will always be dissatisfied. I need to admire. I need to appreciate, but not compare. I admire your ability in music. What a lovely voice. I admire your social skills. You really know how to get along with people well. I admire your house. I admire your smarts. Man, that's a beautiful pool, and I really appreciate that you have it and that you've invited me over to spend time in your pool. Now, I don't know who cleans it. I don't know who does the upkeep on it. I don't know who pays the insurance. But man, it's wonderful that you have it and that you've invited me over to share the joy with you. That's fantastic. You know, I love your car with leather seats. I love that you have a DVD player at every console, at every seat. That's great. I love that you have 35 speakers that you can get surround sound. And you've got, you know, these wide tires. Let's take a spin around the block. But I don't need it. But I'm glad that God has blessed you with it. It was a gift from God to you, and you enjoy it. And I admire that. I appreciate it, but I'm not going to compare myself, and we shouldn't, with someone else's house. We shouldn't compare ourselves with someone else's body. We shouldn't compare ourselves with someone else's car, or their abilities, or their brains, or their intelligence, or their jobs, or their social skills, or their education, or their spirituality, or anything. Wow. Now you think about this for a second. If you take all of that time that we tend to take comparing ourselves with others, and you take and you root that out, what are we going to spend all that extra time thinking about? This is how we live on a regular basis. Well, that car's too much for him. He shouldn't have it. I need it. Well, that skirt is just too tight on her. It looks better on me. He's pretty strong, but not as strong as I am. You know, he's smart, but he's not as smart as I am. He's fast, but he's not as fast as I am. He's spiritual, but he's not as spiritual as I am. I give better prayers than he does. I'm more loving than he is. I'm a better mother than her. And on it goes. We can spend, frankly, all of our time comparing. It's the cord to coveting. We have to cut that. Step number two is rejoice and give thanks for what I do have. Rejoice and give thanks for what I do have. You know, all that spare time that we had, now that we cut it, step number one out, we cut all that comparing out, all that extra time we have, this is what we do with it. Rejoice and give thanks for what we do have. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 18, I'll read it to you for time's sake. Behold, that which I have seen is good and comely for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor that he's taken under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him for his, it is his portion. Every man also to whom God has given riches and wealth and has given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 verse 18. For he shall not much remember the days of his life because God answers him in the joy of his heart. Hard work, enjoy the fruits of your labor. Don't covet the fruits of someone else's labor and don't think, well, if I had this or if I had that. No, let joy live in your heart by rejoicing for the blessings that you do have, for the blessings that God has given you. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 14 says, do all things without murmuring and disputing, that you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom you shine as lights in the world. You know, if you're really wondering about your coveting level, just check on your tongue. Just check in on your tongue. If you complain and you grumble and you're never happy because nothing is ever quite right or nothing is ever good enough because that steak is never fixed to your temperature or to your liking, because that restaurant never has good service, because the checkers are always rude, because the drivers are always too slow. When you grumble and you complain and you whine, one thing is for sure, you're not thankful. But if we're thankful, if we're not thankful, we're out of the will of God. If we're not thankful, we're out of the will of God. I don't know where this is at, but it says in the New Testament, in everything give thanks, for this is the will of God. In everything give thanks. So, willfully choosing to give thanks to God for all things in all situations, doesn't matter if it's a boring job, if it's poor health. At least you have some health. If you didn't have any, you would be dead. Willfully giving thanks for everything will cut the cord of coveting out of your life. Thank you, Lord, for the husband that I do have. Thank you, Lord, for the wife that I do have. Because she puts up with me just like I put up with her. Step number three is share what I have to help others. Share what I do have to help others. You know, this is really the dagger to the heart of coveting. Is giving what you have away. 1 Timothy chapter 6 says, verse 17, 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17 says this. Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. That they do good, right? He says this is what, that they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute and willing to communicate. God wants you and me to enjoy life. He wants us to enjoy your life richly. And he gives us blessings to do it, but he gives us a command that we should do good, that we should be generous and willing to share those things that God has given us with others that don't have as much. You see, the antidote to a coveting heart is to become free of your stuff, of your time, of your resources, To give it away keeps us from being driven with lust. It keeps us from being disillusioned, and it keeps us from being dissatisfied. Most of us spend our time in life trying to figure out how we can go up. How can we go up that ladder? How can we go up that ladder of success? How can we go up that money train? How can we go up that power ladder or that esteem ladder? How can we get up there? But Scripture tells us that there is a seemingly, and it's a seemingly, eternal paradox. That if we spend our lives helping others to go up, that we'll have joy in life. I think Zig Ziglar said something to that effect too. You can get where you want to go if you help everyone get where they want to go. Jesus said it is more blessed to give than to receive. I want to close today with a little snippet of something that was written by Napoleon Hill. He wrote this thing called Contentment. He wrote it called Contentment. It says this, the richest man in the world lives in Happy Valley. He is rich in values that endure, in things he cannot lose. Here is an inventory of his riches and how he acquired them. I found happiness by helping others find it. I found sound health by living temperately and eating only the food my body requires to maintain it. I hate no man, envy no man, but love and respect all mankind. I am engaged in a labor of love with which I mix play generously, therefore I seldom grow tired. I pray daily, not for more riches, but for more wisdom with which to recognize, embrace, and enjoy the great abundance of riches I already possess. I speak no name except only to honor it, and I slander no man for any cause for whatsoever. I ask no favors of anyone except the privilege of sharing my blessings with all who desire them. I am on good terms with my conscience, therefore it guides me accurately in everything I do. I have more material wealth than I need because I am free from greed and covet only those things which I can construct or which I can use constructively while I live. My wealth comes from those whom I have benefited by sharing my blessings. The estate of Happy Valley, which I own, is not taxable. It exists mainly in my own mind. And intangible riches that cannot be assessed for taxation and appropriated except by those who adopt my way of life. I created this estate over a lifetime of effort by observing nature's laws and forming habits to conform with them. End quote. God has a purpose and a reason for the 10th commandment. And he also has a plan to help us in obeying that commandment. If we believe it and we implement it, we will find contentment in a discontented world.